What's Your Poison is proudly brought to you by Whiskey Brother. WhiskeyBrother.com. They make great whiskeys. They sell them. You buy them. You drink them. WhiskeyBrother.com. I'm so excited about this episode. I pestered David Cromer for a long, long time. Not that he didn't want to do it, and maybe he did. Got him there in the end. But it was, I think, because of COVID, you know. He wanted to do something in person. He said to me very early on, if we're going to do this, let's do it in person. Then when the lockdown things eased, we set up a big shoot at his house, and then I had my mum's neighbor's house burned down one night, and everything was chaos. And then I had to sort of move it for a week. Then the following week he was unavailable, and then the new scheduled dates, COVID sort of whacked. I was in a shoot that forced me into quarantine, so we thought, okay, wave three is here, let's not do it in person. We finally did it over the onlines. So this is very important. As this episode comes out, I did this interview last week, and on Sunday, the Sunday we just had, was David Cromer's 70th birthday, and he still looks amazing. He still is amazing. I'm just such a fan, and this was such a special. And you know, I go into these things as a fan, no questions teed up, just asking things I wanted to ask. He was having a nice glass of wine. I was drinking a nice bottle of Baines. I really just loved chatting to him. It was super chill. And I want to do some stuff with him maybe in the future. Who knows? I suppose everyone does. So honored to have one of the biggest icons in human history, the legend David Cromer on What's Your Poison. Don't forget, you can go to johnsavage.com to see other episodes. You can subscribe at whatever, Spotify, Apple. Please leave comments. But without further ado, the icon, the man himself, it's my privilege, David Cromer! Hooray!
Hey, how's it?
Mr. David Cromer, I am so excited. I've been looking forward to this. I've been nagging for a good what?
Yeah, well, it's nice to see you. And is everything okay? Can you hear me okay? And the camera all good?
You look amazing and you sound amazing. And I'm just happy to see you and chat to you.
Good, thank you.
Do you have your poison with you?
I do.
Yay. So let's start with the important stuff. What are you drinking and why? That's the question.
Okay. So I'm drinking, this is a Chardonnay. The bottle is it's from Sutherland Chardonnay. And why am I drinking it? I drink white wine mostly these days. It's nice to drink in the evening. I have a sundowner, although not much sun today.
Plenty of rain today. I don't know if you had rain on your side of the mountain. We had torrential on this side.
Yeah. No, we had quite, especially last night, there were a lot of rain, yeah. But, and you, what are you drinking? Whiskey?
Tonight, I'm going super local. I'm going Baines tonight. So what I try to do is choose a whiskey while I choose a drink for each of our guests. For something that I think is befitting to the occasion. And I just, you know, there is only one local one. You are our local legend. So I had to, I went Baines. So cheers to you. I'm just sorry. I know we try to make a plan to come to you and do this in person. But the world is working in its own mysterious ways currently.
It is. No, it's fun. I just like doing these. It doesn't matter. I've got used to this now, you know, and I'm sure you do.
It's not ideal.
Yeah. But I'm not on this kind of Zoom. What do you call this? StreamYard? I don't do this a lot. So I suppose when you first asked me, I thought, sit and chat and just look at a screen. But as you say, you know, this is what we have to do. So
and the drinking helps.
Maybe the drinking will like oil the cogs a little bit, eh? Yeah.
Well, can I ask you, just on the subject, then we'll move on. Was white wine always your poison of choice, or in the good old bad old days?
No, not always. I suppose when I was younger, it was much more of a kind of a beer, a lager guy, you know. I'm not a guy that drinks a lot, but like, you know, brying and, you know, when I used to make a bry and in the evenings, a few cold beers, that was, you know, that was my poison when many years ago. And I somehow switched over to drinking wine. What I can't drink is, I can't drink red wine. Red wine gives me a hangover, even if I drink a little bit of it, you know. So I think it's the sulfur or something in the red wine, but I'm not much of a spirits drinker, you know. But there we go. It's just a way of passing the time in the evening, but you know, before supper.
And you were never experiment. Were you into drugs that ever in your life in the old days, or
what drugs?
Yeah.
No. I wasn't into that. As a student, my student years, bit of grass, you know, as far as I went with drugs. I never got into anything heavy.
Mm.
Yeah.
Me neither.
I didn't. I don't have that kind of need in some ways. Yeah. The wine is more really just a pleasant sort of thing to do, you know, especially when there's company. It's nice to have a glass of something with someone else and with a meal, you know, with a meal and so on. But I don't drink to forget my problems or my sorrows. And, you know, I've not turned to drugs or alcohol or anything like that.
If lockdown hasn't turned you, then you have a strong resilience.
No, yeah, it's been amazing. I really haven't... I haven't had to do anything like that, you know. I mean, I think some people probably have, you know, started drinking much more wine, or, you know, they're not in their usual working environment, or they're at home and suddenly feel you can walk around in your pajamas and your slippers all day and, you know, open the bottle of wine at 11 in the morning.
I took my dressing gown off for you.
Yeah, there you go. Well, I'm just sitting here in my underpants here.
I was at an award ceremony the other day that had my suit and tie and then my undies down below.
Yeah, well. I suppose it's fun to do something like that. No one knows unless you forget and stand up on the
There was I don't know if you saw that. There was that American politician who did something like that, who had like no pants on and then stood up in front of Congress afterwards. Yeah. Didn't know his camera was still on.
I saw it, but I heard about that. Yeah. Some embarrassing moments. So it can happen,
David,
I'm sure.
When this show goes out in a couple of days, you will have just turned 70.
I'm turning 70 on Sunday, the 27th of June. Yeah,
that's on Sunday. That's now.
Yeah,
that is incredible. Sure. You look amazing, and you are amazing still. How do you feel about that? Do you have any weirdness about turning 70?
No, I don't. It certainly is a milestone. You know, these big ones, you know, when you turn 60, you think, okay, well, I wonder what I'll be doing, you know, in the next 5 years, next 10 years and so on. And, you know, I think the only sort of downside now of turning 70 is that the theatre industry, is absolutely flat at the moment. Mm-hmm. There's not much to do, as a performer or as a writer or director. So that's a disappointment. I kind of imagined that at 70, I would still be, you know, still be keeping my hand in and going, doing things. And, you know, especially in the theater world, I felt like it would still go on for a few years. At the moment, I don't know where we stand, you know. So I must say that the last year, that's been difficult in kind of dealing with the sense of loss. You know, it felt like it's like a death. It's a death that takes place. You suddenly feel, oh, well, you know, that big part of my life, that very important part, is suddenly not there. And I suppose what COVID did is to, you know, just to bring that on in very, very quickly and very dramatically. It's the kind of thing you think you're going to ease into in your 70s, you know, sort of slowly, you know, kind of. So it's like suddenly you plunged into retirement. But apart from that, I'm healthy. I'm feeling, I'm okay about it. You know, I'm okay. I didn't have the energy that I had in my younger days. And that's the only thing I'm starting to feel now that you know, when you are in the old days, you know, you really put huge energy into everything I was doing, big physical energy, you know. I just find I'm going a little more slowly these days. It's a little more slow.
This lockdown, I mean, this is one of those things, is that, I mean, you were active right up. I think you didn't have a production that started last year, right before the pandemic,
yeah.
Even.
Yeah, well, this was why it was so shocking, because I had a musical running at the Baxter Theatre, which we started in 2019, and then it was, you know, we had a second season come up in February of 2020, and so we just started, we'd been running about a week or 10 days or so when COVID hit, and the Baxter decided, you know, they and wisely so, they should shut down the production. Suddenly there we were, you know, we were all out of work, and you know, and no more. Yeah, I miss that, you know. I miss the fact that I wasn't able to go to the theater as often, and, you know, suddenly you couldn't go at all. And so, yeah, I had a production and stopped. That was it.
And what I was going to ask, I also saw The Few God closed down as well, which was unbelievable. Unbelievable.
Yeah, well, it's heartbreaking. I mean, it was absolutely heartbreaking because I mean, the last 6-7 years, I've been working at the Foo God, you know, a production every 18 months or 2 years or so. And, you know, I think I had 5 productions there.
Crazy.
Yeah. And a fantastic, wonderful place to work, you know, great people, production qualities, superb, you know, it really was such a pleasure to work at the Foo God, and heartbreaking to think that that's not going to be there anymore. You know, it's not even a case of, well, maybe, you know, in a few months' time, or, you know, it'll open again. It's not going to open, you know, I don't think.
You know, I think one of the weirdest things and the kind of strangest things is that the more time. And this is, it must be something in our psychology. And I'm also, like you, I'm very active in creative space. But the more time you kind of spend at home, not doing all those things, you sort of get comfortable and now if you need to go out and get something, like to actually muster the strength to leave the house and go and do something, seems like a massive task.
No, it's not like that for me. Yeah, you know, because I spent a lot of time at home. I mean, my work was all done at home, sitting, you know, in my den, writing and thinking about things, and then went going out in the evening to the theater, and, you know, so I looked forward to going out, and that's been taken away. So whenever I get an opportunity now to go and do the shopping or something like that, I'll go. I'm kind of missing not being able to get out. You know, I really am missing that.
Interesting. I've had such an opposite. I've been so like traveling, doing all these things. I never really want to leave this room again.
But it's interesting because, you know, some people have been very busy, and then, you know, they found the time that they could tackle the projects, you know, that they always wanted to do. They've been talking about, you know, writing that book or novel or, you know, whatever they were wanting to
starting
do,
this podcast,
procrastinating and whatever, you know, and then suddenly, well, now you have the time, you know, so come on, do the job now. And and for me it was completely different, you know. Suddenly I just felt I didn't feel like writing anything. I didn't write any songs. I didn't have any big ideas for the next musical. I didn't feel, oh, okay, now I'm going to use this year to do that. I actually, it's kind of like the lights just went out in that part of my brain. And so to pass the time, because I was really bored, you know, I picked up my paints and my brushes and I just started painting again.
Cool.
I hadn't painted for decades. You know, it was a sort of a thing I did at school and in my younger years. And once I got involved with music and musical theatre, that wasn't something I ever did until last year. So that's kept me busy. I mean, and you know, I needed something to do, but otherwise, maybe I would have, you know, been tackling more of this stuff.
I did. You did come out of the woodwork for. I mean, first of all, I think it's a pity that your particular industry, theatre, quite hard to adapt to the online environment. Doesn't quite work.
No, it doesn't
But
work.
I loved. What was it that you came out and did an amazing performance? Was it on the Dave? It was something. Was it the thing with the Dave? Dave Matthews was on it. You were on it. What was that concert again?
That was the Johnny Clegg. We did that for Johnny Clegg.
That's right. Was it with? It was with
With Corin Zoid and
Karin Zoid, yeah.
all that. Yeah, Corin Zoid, we recorded that at Corin Zoid's studio. And yeah, so there were a whole lot of, you know, Art Matthews and Dave Matthews and a lot of people came and participated in that. And so I was, you know, I was very pleased to be asked and to be part of it. And I think it was to raise funds, it was some kind of charity that
It
Johnny
was, I think it was Dinner on Wheels, wasn't it? It was Dinner on
something else.
Wheels.
I can't quite remember now, but anyway, it was for a good cause, and it was
I love
beautifully
that you
done.
popped up on that. And I loved your performance as well. It was so unexpected and fierce and cool. And I love to see you out and about.
And then in the early days of COVID, within the first week or so, we put Skull Kubert from Cape Town Music Academy put together also one of these, you know, things where we got a lot of people to participate, and it took my Welcome to Cape Town song that Tally Peterson and I had written many years ago, and I rewrote the lyrics, you know, describing Cape Town as a ghost city and all, you know, welcome. I can't remember quite what we wrote, but we did that in very early on, kind of thinking, well, in a few weeks' time, it'll all, you know, go back to normal, and we'll, you know, we'll keep on dancing, we'll keep on smiling, you know, until Futsek Corona. It was called Sek Corona. I don't know if you saw that, but that had a lot of hits on the internet. But I must say, you know, we were thinking that it would last. Remember the first lockdown, we thought about 6 weeks or so, you know, and then it dragged on and on and on. And
It's still dragging on.
we are 15 months later. We still are, you know, we're not out of the woods.
No, I've just had a whole film set shut down for COVID, and we had to just press stop on the entire production and then go home and quarantine. I'm now in quarantine.
Okay. Well, yeah, a lot of, and I mean, this has happened in the theatre as well. Just as they started to creep back, you know, like at the Baxter Theatre, they were doing this production of Michael Kay, the J.M. Coetzee story, and they were about to, you know, perform it here in Cape Town and then go on to Germany. And well, that someone got COVID there; they had to shut the whole thing down. There's another play that Paul du Toit was involved with. The Assassin's Wife or Assassin's Girlfriend, I think it was called, that had to shut down because of COVID. You know, you just as you think, okay, well, it's starting to normalize, we're starting to get out of the. But at my age, you know, I've tried to be very careful. I really have
Of
not,
course.
I've not been stupid. I mean, I walk through down on the beachfront here in Camps Bay, and you know, you see the way people are carrying on, you know. Huddled together, no masks, laughing, drinking.
I've
Wow.
definitely seen a few places where COVID doesn't exist in South
Well,
Africa.
People have just reached a point now where they're just kind of like,
It's fed
it's
up.
not gonna happen. It's not gonna happen to me, you know. It happens to other people. It's that sort of thing. So
Ish.
you're just in quarantine. You haven't had it yet.
I haven't had, I think actually today's my last day. I think I'm done, but it's protocol really. You know, when you do these sets, as you know, if there's a lot of people, one person got positive tests and then you just, the thing gets closed off. I was actually, and I wasn't allowed to fly. So I just drove myself back home from Joburg in my rental car. I just got in the car and came home. I didn't want to stay there.
Wow. And
But
what were you doing on the film? What do you do on film?
I was I'm directing a new TV show that's coming out in July. We got most of the way there. We're just missing the last two episodes, which we'll hopefully get in a couple of weeks. So yeah, I'm involved in lots of interesting, weird things. Which brings me on to this. I wanted to. I don't know if this is an apology or what this is. This is my memory. When I first, well, when I kind of last first met you for real, I had invited you to come onto my crazy Mash Lab program.
You did, yes.
And it was one of my all-time highlights. You and I, we went for a drink. We went and had a glass of wine on the Camps Bay, on that, in the hotel there, the Bay Hotel Theater, whatever, thing there. And I loved it. And we chatted, and
I remember, yeah, at the hotel there, yeah, on the
it was
deck.
such an amazing moment for me. And I thought, oh, I'm going to be friends with David Cromer. This is all I've ever wanted. And then we went into our Mash Lab, and it was a freaking disaster. And I was always embarrassed to talk to you after that because it just was so hectic. What and it was the hardest, weirdest, most trickiest Mash Lab we ever did. It was the only one that really went wrong.
Right. I thought you'd kind of engineered it in a way that there would be friction between the artists and that it would make for good television, maybe.
Yeah, we did get good television, but you know, respecting a lot of the work I'm involved in is about respecting and creating space for our legacy artists. And I was so excited that you were in this project, and I just didn't have any of the qualities that I was wanting to. So I just didn't ever know what to, I just kind of like went, I can never talk to David Cromer again.
It was a well, I mean, you engineered the hookup,
It could
but
have
I
been
don't know.
genius, though. It had the potential to be life-changingly genius. It just happened to be a disaster.
Well, it I don't know. I mean, we didn't really see eye to eye. The two artists, myself and Toya de Lazy, we just weren't on the same wavelength at all. So and yeah, that it could have, I mean, collabs are really interesting. I've done one recently with a, I don't know if I'm allowed to talk about it, but I did one with a very popular young Afrikaans band, and it was just great working with them, and their approach and their respect for the work. There was huge respect for the work and for myself, and it was just fun for me to go into a studio with a younger energy, and that's what it should have been like. But unfortunately, on the one that you did, we never really kind of clicked on that one. We didn't click creatively. There was kind of a sense of a perhaps a clash of egos, I'd say. There was a kind of an ego. There was a big ego in the room, which I don't think was mine, but possibly. And that got in the way. That
Yeah.
just really got in the way.
I remember this. I did a bit of what do you call it? Chicanery. What is that, the right word? Trickery. You know what I did, the way I saved that there were four episodes with the two of you, and it went from like totally lovey-dovey to like awesome to bad to unbearable. And what I did when I launched them, I swapped them around so it looked like you guys had a fight in the middle and then you made up at the end and there was a happy ending. But the that was how I sort of manipulated that.
You still like it used to did we go into Radio 5, something like that, every time we co did we spoke to, how's it going and all that stuff. Yeah.
So there were two things. There was a video series that went out on YouTube, and then there was the live check-ins on five of them.
Yeah. Anyway, somebody was talking. The piece that I eventually did in the middle, which was very different style to me.
I think you weren't happy with it either. I don't think you were happy with what you felt pressured to do in that situation.
It didn't reflect the kind of work that I would do, I suppose. And it didn't, I mean, I don't think it was recognizably anything in my David Cromer style. So it was more like, wow, okay, so David Cromer, like, well, that's a surprise, you know. There was that sort of surprise element in it. But it's not something I walked away from thinking, wow, that was, I'm so glad I did that. And, you know, it's not a song that I will ever kind of listen to or say.
I think the song is shit, I'll be honest. And I've been eternally embarrassed and sad that I mean, that's the way it happened. I think that's part of the charm or the risk of a forced collaboration. Not all artists are up to being a pressure cooker on a collaboration. You were up for it.
But the thing was, look, John, I mean, but you also were kind of looking, I mean, there was that element in it. You did say to me at the time, let's just see what happens. You know, it could go well, it could go badly. Whatever happens, it's going to be entertaining, which I'm sure it was for some people. I try to be cool about the whole thing. I don't think I ever really.
You were super cool about the whole thing.
I tried to be cool about it. You know, it was kind of afterwards. I was sort of bemused by the whole process.
I was horrified if that.
Okay, next on the agenda.
Okay, so the next on the agenda is this. At that same time, you told me then, because I think you and I had a bit of time when Toya was in the studio, where you kind of said, you've got albums in you still.
Mm-hmm.
And
you said, I'd love to produce that and record it or something, you
that's
said.
That's right. But that was right before I stopped talking to you forever.
I never heard from you again.
So do you still have those albums? Are you still keen on maybe?
I recorded that album.
That album.
It was called Vakaslop. Vakaslop, and I did it. We put a band together and we rehearsed in this room that I'm sitting in now, and then we recorded it. I got the RSG at the SABC. They gave me studio time because they said,
beautiful.
You know, they wanted some. They wanted some Afrikaans music, you know. They needed. When was I going to do another album? They were asking me, and I said, "Well, you know, in these days, with the financing an album is really doesn't make any sense anymore. You know, to put a lot of money into an album with sales non-existent and trying to, you know, recoup on streaming and so on." Which was the reason I wasn't really rushing into the studio to record a new album, because the costs are just too high and the returns are too low. So they said to me, okay, well, we'll give you the studio, you know, you can. And that, so I had the studio at the SABC for a week, and we recorded that album there, and that made
the one
it,
down in Cape Town, the one on the beachfront,
yeah, in Sea Point, yeah. Yeah, and very nice studio, lovely. It's a bit like the kind of Abbey Road kind of feel in that studio. Like,
I love it. Those SABC rooms are the greatest.
It's from the old days, you know, the paneled walls very nice. And the engineer there was excellent. And then it was mixed by Tally McCulley.
Cool.
But since that's the last album I did. I've got a few songs. I've written a few more songs since then, but I'm not as fired up anymore. You know, I've got to record this next album. I'm not finding the the whole way the industry's changed, it's not easy for someone like me. You know, when I was on such a wave, you during the 80s, you know, when you're selling truckloads of vinyl albums, you know, hundreds of thousands of albums, and which translates into many, many performances around the country. And then, you know, to grapple with this new way of kind of getting yourself out there on the internet and being taken completely for a ride by the streaming companies. I mean, you know, what we get paid for a stream on a song, it's just highway robbery. I mean, it's awful. I don't know who makes these decisions and why artists have let this happen.
I think it's in transition. You know, the road to where we have gotten, if you look at it, then you can understand how it is where it is. You know, what the streaming platforms did, the thing they did that was good, that has led us to where we are, this is just my opinion, obviously, is that they actually ended piracy. You know, piracy was becoming, because this new generation of people were just downloading music for nothing. And iTunes wasn't able, like, people weren't buying albums on iTunes because they could just download it for nothing. So iTunes singles.
You're talking about Napster days.
Well, even long after, I'm talking about like 5 years ago, like long after Napster, when CDs were dying and iTunes was the biggest thing in the world and Spotify didn't really exist, iTunes was still trying to sell singles and albums, which were easily stolen off of online. So you could easily steal on the Napster type things. When Spotify introduced a model that was basically everything you can download for next to nothing, which was there's the freebie service and then a low pay service, it stopped piracy in its tracks. And even though the price we're paying now, and I think it's transitional, like we're in the transitional period.
Yeah, I hope so. I saw it, originally I had some albums as downloads, and that worked quite well for a while. And then as you've described it, it started to die out, the downloading, and then streaming came in. But it's just sad that the money that they pay per stream is, I mean, I understand it's like Netflix or whatever, you pay your 100 rand a month, you know, and you can get as much.
Everybody gets a peanut.
Yeah, as much as you like, but we all get a peanut. Thanks very much. Look, it's an income stream. I'm not, I get money every 6 weeks or so. I get quite a reasonable check from them, because people are listening to my music all over the world. I have, that's what's quite interesting. I mean, it has done that, but if instead of it being 0.01 of an American cent, if it was just 0.03, it would be so much more worthwhile.
No, I mean
the model is just not a very it doesn't respect artists and creative work very much, and it's been decided by the big companies somewhere, and I don't think that there have been any strong kind of organizations like songwriting composers organizations or performers organizations who've challenged this, hard enough. You got like individual artists like, say, Beyonce, creating her own platform, just giving them the finger, which, you kind of felt, why didn't more people do that?
Well, and she's then, still on those other platforms, just at the same time. She can't afford to not be on them.
Yeah, but...
No, you know what?
The big guys are selling their catalogs now. We've heard,
I can't believe Bob Dylan sold his catalog. I mean, that's the craziest thing I've ever heard.
Yeah, well, I suppose again, at his age, These are kind of decisions that make sense to you, you know, to if you want to, I don't know, I suppose with it must be very difficult to tie up a legacy like that, and then to translate it into something that's more usable for yourself. I can kind of understand it,
this is maybe unhelpful. My opinion on this is that I don't think the big tech companies have created the situation. I'm not a fan of them. I'm not saying they're not wrong. I'm not saying that they're not dominating the space, but I think they're responding to where the industry is where it is, and this is the response to where the industry is. You can't force nobody, like these new kids who they don't know, they've never bought an album in their lives. But buying an album doesn't make any sense to them.
Let me suggest this to you. If you look at the Netflix model, right? I think that's a much better
model. They license from you up front.
They pay you. They pay you.
Yeah.
They say, okay, we like your work, or you've presented something to them, a movie. Here's $100,000. Make the movie, right?
I'm in agreement with where you're going with this.
Yeah. So you get the money, you know what you're going to get, and you budget your movie, and everybody gets paid, and you come out with a few dollars, you know, yourself, the producer. Now it belongs to Netflix, and they can stream it as much as they like. Fine, that works perfectly. But with music, it doesn't work like that. They don't say to the artists, you know, here's $1 million. You know, create a wonderful album for me, and then we'll own it. No, I'm just a small fish, and I'm a tiny little fish, but there's so many like me. You go into the studio, you have to spend this money, create you do have to spend money to make a nice album, get the sound and the musicians and so on, but at your expense, and then they can stream it.
I'm going to challenge this idea, because the difference is, in the streaming world, they don't take your songs. You have to give it to them. So,
sure. But so what else can you do?
No, well, that's my point. Is like with Netflix, first of all, like getting into Netflix is very tricky. Like there is such a bottleneck, or to get into the Netflix world, you got to know someone who knows someone. So those independent filmmakers, you know what they're doing? They're putting their stuff on YouTube and using the same crappy monetization model that Spotify, like what you're talking about, because that's what is available to them. Now, in the Spotify universe, they're not just taking all the free stuff. You have to volunteer or elect to put your music on there. What you're saying is there should be a premium music service where people are licensing your music for.
Be quite nice. That would be nice.
Cool. Yeah, would be cool. Yeah, I agree. Cool.
So there was a kind of like a South African streaming platform, you know, and they came along and they said to you, okay, here's R100,000, you know, and give us 10 songs or something like that, you know. That would be nice. Then you know where you're going with it, and maybe they make 500,000 from it. Well, that's fine.
And it's quite a cool idea.
You're not
because
out of pocket, you know, you're not out of pocket, and it's very, very hard when you're a small fry little small fish. It's very hard to make back the investments. And again, you know, everyone's making music. It's on, you know, at home. There are too many people making music. It doesn't, you know, you don't get the quality of musicianship.
But it's quite nice. What you're suggesting is quite cool.
I sound like a grumpy old
man. No, but you've given me a nice idea, because if there was a premium music service, right, that licensed stuff, but because they paid for the license, it wasn't available anywhere else. So like Beyonce could do 5 albums for Spotify and 1 album for Chromify, let's call it, right? And Chromify buys that album, and the only place on earth you get that special album. So it could be like a place for special projects or high value music or something. That's a nice idea there.
Something like that. Kind of a, sort of a Netflix model for music, but running alongside the Spotify idea.
I like it. I'll invest. Here's, I think I've got 75 Rand left. You can have it.
Why does my face look so pink? Is it the white wine that makes me look so pink, do you think?
I don't know. I hope so. It means it's working.
I look like a complete alcoholic in this light.
Right. Well, that'll be the byline for this particular episode. David Cromer admits he's an alcoholic.
I look like one.
La 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 la, didn't hear the details. You know how the social media works. So I wanted to ask you a little bit about, I know, like, one of the things that is amazing about you is that you have this legendary status. Your career is unbelievable. But there was this 5-year period where you were a mega megastar back in the day. I think when we spoke, one of the things that was interesting is how you set yourself up. I was interested in how you were smart enough to recognize, right? Unlike a lot of artists, a lot of great artists, this little period I'm in is going to be a finite time. I'm going to, like, invest in my future. I'm going to figure out what I'm going to set myself up. Is that, and then you did all the most amazing things. It was like the VW Combi days, obviously. It was the where David Cromer was everywhere days, and managed to sort of set your whole career up from them. Is that an accurate description? Have I overstepped?
It's nearly accurate. It wasn't as carefully sort of thought out like that. I was responding to what was happening to me, and it was happening really quickly.
What was that moment where you went, okay, now I'm on the wave, I'm not chasing it, I'm on it?
I didn't set out to achieve anything like that. That's the difference. I wasn't, you see, again, you have to contextualize the time. And if you go back to that time in South Africa, there was hardly anybody making music professionally. It wasn't a career choice. Mm. Okay, today it's very different. It's very, very different today. There's a whole industry. Or at least there was. If you just look at the Afrikaans music scene, you know, it exploded. But in the 80s, there was really no Afrikaans music scene until Anton Goosen and I came along. Before that, it was just Gay Corsten and singing, and Sonia Harold singing, you know, and awful bloody translations of German pop music on the radio in Afrikaans. So what the Afrikaans listener, you know, or the Afrikaans speaking fan was going to country and Western concerts. That's what they attended. Mm-hmm. in their thousands, you know, people like I forget their names now. I can kind of anyway. So when it took me by surprise, when I made that album, the first album, I wasn't expecting it. I certainly knew they weren't going to play it on the radio.
Right, James Phillips. Is that who you were thinking? No,
not James. No, I'm talking about country and Western people. I mean, Barbara Ray. These are people who were in the 70s and early 80s they were the performing artists, and they did country songs, you know, country, right. American country songs, and that's what the Afrikaans speaking market was buying tickets for. And then, as I say, and then there was people like Gey Corsten and a bit of Sonia Herold and so on. And there was nobody writing in the style that Anton and I came with, which was much more based on kind of using street Afrikaans and describing characters and people and situations that were real. There was a realism in it. We moved we moved away from sentimentality and moved the goalposts into a kind of a much more real. There was more realism in Afrikaans popular music. I mean, so real that they wouldn't play it for me in my case. But it took me by surprise because I you know, when you fame just arrived suddenly for me, you know, it suddenly I had a cult status. I was like very alternative to mainstream. I was you know, I had a lot of kind of left-wing students following, and then I started working in Afrikaans, and then I had this hit with Hakon Blokkies.
How old were you at this time at this moment?
Huh?
How old were you at this moment?
I was 29.
Cool.
I was 29. And so the first, and then it rocketed up to number one on the Springbok radio charts. And you know, I had a hit there. It stayed at number one for 12 weeks. So my life changed within a few days. I just went from being an ordinary guy who played his guitar as a hobby at the Barleycorn Folk Club in Rosebank to my phone ringing off the hook, you know, and suddenly being you know, desperately a kind of commodity that everybody wanted, and a superstar in some ways. And there's no way to prepare for that, you know. So you have to think on your feet. And basically, I suppose I just had a sense of a kind of, because I'd been in the textile business, I had a sense of what I should do with the success, and not just, you know, I kind of had a little bit of a forward thinking approach.
Did you have any guidance or support structure, or were you just on your own in a brand new space that no one had been in before?
Yeah, it was a brand new space. Certainly for me, it was a brand new space. And I used to go out there, and at first I was just performing on my own, you know, setting up my own PA. I mean, it was crazy, you know. And then I would go and play in a town like Malmesbury all on my own, set up my own PA, get out there, sing the songs. And then when I came out, you know, it was like being one of the Beatles, you know. I virtually got my clothes ripped off me, you know. It was unexpected. Things like that happened to me that I just didn't know. And then it got so bad that I couldn't go anywhere. You know, I just couldn't go anywhere. I couldn't go on holiday in this country with my family or anything like that. It was just too difficult. So, yeah, I found that part of it quite hard to adapt to. But I mean, I think what you're suggesting is that there was quite a lot of strategy in, you know, but I had a sense, but there wasn't really, but I had a sense of branding. I mean, I had a sense that I was different, and the way I looked at, and my music was different. The songs I was writing was different. So I dressed differently. I felt that the clothes I wore had to reflect what I was writing about. I had to have a South African essence and all of that kind of stuff. So there was a lot of thought went into what I was doing, and I believed in everything that I was doing. I wasn't chasing some kind of gimmick, you know. which I think a lot of people thought that I was sort of chasing something.
So I don't mean that at all. I think the thing that is impressive to me, you know, every year, multiple times a year, the headline news is that some incredible, prolific, important national treasure passes away, can't afford their own hospital bills, right? But the one thing I know that you did, I think at that time, I might be wrong, was you bought a house. Yes. You made the smartest commercial investment that if the rest of your career had gone south, you protected your future. And that to me is so unlike any other story I've heard.
So the financial advice I got was, if you have a bond on your house, pay off the bond. That's the best investment you can make. Pay off your bond. So with Hakon Blokkies, I was able to pay off the bond within 3 months.
Wow. And yeah. Is it the same house you're in now in Camps Bay?
No.
So it's a different house. Yeah.
Yeah. So the house in Oranjezicht was paid for by Blokkies Hubert.
Amazing. Incredible.
And this house in Camps Bay was paid for by District 6 the musical.
Amazing.
Yeah. So I invested. Yeah, I didn't spend my money recklessly. I didn't buy fancy motor cars or go on, you know, fancy overseas trips, and I didn't throw extravagant parties or anything. I kept whatever money I made, I invested. But until a point where I stopped in 1986, I took a break. And in that year, I wrote Baboon Dogs. I released Baboon Dogs, which was a reworking of the songs I'd written in the 1970s. But I also wrote District 6, the musical with Tully Peterson. And there, I went into a co-production with the Baxter Theatre. And so I put up half the money for that. And that turned into a huge success. And then when we had to renegotiate that, I brought Tully Peterson in as a third producer. And so the second season of District 6, the musical, was myself, Tully Peterson, and of course my wife is always involved in all of this. She's like, you know, it's the two of us. When I say eyes, it's the two of us together. So it was Tully Peterson, the Kramers, and the Baxter Theatre. And that was a huge success, District 6, the musical. And then all the other musicals that Tully and I went on to write, we financed ourselves. We produced everything ourselves. So we took the money from the previous success and we invested in the next project, which gave us the freedom, you see, because usually you can't find the money to do these things. You have to keep begging, you know, looking for investors. But we had the money and we were lucky enough to continue to write hits. So we went from District 6, the musical, into Fairyland, which ran for 1,500 performances. After that, we did Poison, which went to Malaysia. And when we came back from Malaysia, Talib and I wrote Cut and the Kings. And then Cut and the Kings just took off. And that was our big international success. And we were busy with Cut and the Kings for the next 10 years until we wrote Guma. Before Talib was murdered. But yeah, we had a lot of success, but we didn't piss it away.
That's a very unique story. I'm sure you recognize that.
Yeah.
They're not pissing it away bit.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think it always, I suppose, because in terms of where I come from and my family history and so on, I was always, not always, but I mean, I had a sense of when I'm this age now, you know, where will I be? Will I be sitting at some bar in some rundown hotel, you know, saying, yeah, well, you know, I was that, oh, you know, I, You should have heard me when I was young, you know.
Remember the Foxy Bus ad? That was me. No, really, it was.
No, that was me. And I mean, that's the story of Cutting the Kings. It's the story of someone who was very talented when they were young and then ends up on the street. And I suppose there's a subconscious fear. Mm. There was a subconscious fear of becoming a has-been and ending up. You know, it because my parents wouldn't have wanted me to become a professional musician. You know, that's not what they wanted. They wanted me to have a steady job and retire with a pension. You know, that's
did
what
they get to see you succeed.
Yeah, they did.
Cool. That's really cool. Amazing.
You freeze. Yeah. Do I freeze like you do or not?
No. I think I was waiting for you to say the next word, and then when you didn't, I just jumped.
No, your image kind of freezes occasionally, and you're just like, oh.
No, I'm okay. Doing good here. And then I have to just, I when I like going to see the Calcutta Blues thing, that blew I mean, first of all, not only was it great, it was weird. It was like the weirdest thing I'd ever seen and just absolutely genius on so many levels. And I guess you've explained it in a way that because you and Talib set up yourselves to be truly independent, it's like sometimes you see an amazing TV show that's so kind of odd, you think, who would finance such a thing? But it's brilliant. And that's how I felt watching that. Like, it was so unexpected, it was so left of field, it was so like authentic. No one would ever have put their money into that project, yet it was like a game-changing, amazing project. That.
Yeah, thank you. It was. It's. It was a very special time, and you know, it's just a pity that in this country we haven't understood that aspect of our music, and. Had more respect for it. I mean, even the fact that you say how strange it was and how, you know, I mean, the fact that roots music, I mean, this is the roots music of South Africa, of Afrikaans roots music. Why should it be so? Why? Why
did it was strange to see in the Baxter. It was the way it was presented was so like street. It was so real.
Yeah, those were real, real people playing their guitars in their eccentric ways and singing in their eccentric style. But no one had ever seen it before in the city. You know, it was the stuff that no one knew existed. I mean, that's the shame. The shame is that we didn't even know that it was there. Okay, it's not quite, it's still there, but it's not to the same extent, and I just caught the last echoes of it, but you know, people were strange about that because they didn't really know how to react or respond to that show or those people, but it had an amazing impact. It was an amazing impact, and it's just so sad that, you know, that it was done at the end of their lives. I mean, almost every one of those musicians have died, except for Hannes, the teaspoon player.
And how did you end up, how long did it take you to put that team together? Like, how did you, was it something that just happened over the years and then you put it together? Or was it something that you spent time investing in putting that? How did you actually get?
So this is how this, when I was a student, at Leeds, I was reading Bob Dylan's biography and, you know, his relationship with Woody Guthrie. Yes. And so that's when I heard about Woody Guthrie. And I had the wonderful opportunity of seeing Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee perform.
What? Where?
Yeah. At the university. I went there. And, you know, just right in front of me. Spent a whole evening with Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee and was blown away by that authenticity and, you know, experiencing real blues artists. You know, this is the thing. I've heard real blues artists, people who have a right to play blues music, not other people who've appropriated blues.
I understand. I understand what you're saying.
So I started to really think about roots music, and then I got to read about the Lomax family, the father and son that went out and made the first recordings of the blues artists like Lead Belly, and you know, in the prisons and down in the Delta, Mississippi Delta, the first, all those early recordings that were made, Robert Johnson, those kind of people, you know, that are in the Library of Congress today, and are, is the fountain of everything that came after it, all the rock music and everything that came out of that original blues music. And the Lomax family went out with this huge tape recorder in the boot of their motor car, and they recorded these people, and they recorded cowboy music, and they recorded Mexican music, and you know, all these kind of folk styles in America. And I kept thinking, well, what do we have? You know, what do I know? If I'm going to base my songwriting on roots music, then what do I have? And I realized that the only thing that I knew about were these kind of lickies that I'd heard on the farms, that the farm musicians had been singing, you know, these kind of old Afrikaans tunes. And when I came back in 1974, I thought this is what I was going to do. I was going to go out to the farms with my tape recorder. I was going to find these musicians, and I was going to record them. I was going to be like the Lomax, you know, the Lomax family of South Africa.
That was going to be me.
Yeah. But I came back, and the harsh reality of apartheid scared me off that project. I realized that, you know, being a lone white man wandering around, you know, the workers' cottages on some bourse à place, might get me into a seriously complicated situation.
I didn't recognizable at this point as well, right?
I mean, to my regret, I mean, I had that idea in 1974-75, and I never followed through on it. And what a pity, you know, what a pity I didn't do that, because there would have been, the music was still much more lively at that time, you know. And when I finally went out with Jan Horn in 2000, we went traveling looking for people this is 25 years later. I go out with Jan Horn, and when he approached me to say, let's go and look for the Kariki Mensa, and you know, who play these old guitars, I said, we won't find them, you know, it's over, it's gone, it's finished, these people don't exist anymore. But Jan, to his credit, went out and drove 10,000 kilometers looking for musicians, and he found them, and then he took me to them to do this TV program, which is called Langpat. And when I met the first of these people, like Hannes Kutsi with the teaspoon, and the Moers family and so on, my wife said to me, Rene said to me, you've got to bring these people on stage with you, you know, you've got to show the city, you've got to show people in the city what is out there. You shouldn't just keep it to yourself, you know, this is too special. And so we did the first concert in, I think it was 2001, at the Kaka and Ka in Oudtshoorn. And it was phenomenal. It was just phenomenal. I mean, the reaction, people just burst into tears when they saw those people playing.
It is definitely the thing for your incredible career that you've had, that was the thing that had the most significant impact on me. Just, it was wild, wildly amazing. So amazing. Okay,
It had a huge impact on me as well. I mean, it's, I'm so glad. Yeah, as I said, I'm just so glad that I was able to be part of that just for those few years. And I'm so glad that those people had an opportunity to be treated with respect and to find their dignity on stage, you know. They really loved being able to play their music in under proper conditions, you know, proper lighting, proper sound, audiences of, you know, hundreds who just loved them and appreciated them. So the last few years of their lives were very special, and I'm glad that I, you know, I had a part in that. That really, it was an amazing time, and they were amazing people. And I'm just, you know, my only regret is that South Africa doesn't honor the kind of the legacy of that music.
It's actually, we don't honor any of our legacy music for some reason that I can't understand. That's the tragedy. That boggles my mind.
Yeah, we still keep chasing the overseas dream, you know. I mean, just chasing all the time. The only people that are really successful have been the people that have had some kind of indigenous influences and indigenous roots. You know, and you think of someone like Johnny Clegg, you know, it's that's what the rest of the world is interested in.
I will tell you something that will give you some happiness. I think there is a movement. I see the time, so I will not take you. Give me another 5 minutes and then I'll let you be. There's a lot of things happening in the music industry now in a way that I've never seen before. And that is, there are incredible young artists like Moonchild Sanelly, Shoma Jozi, that the world is desperate. Like, you know, and always before the last couple of years, I've always felt like, oh, South African artists have to go overseas to get made, or that the international community has to poach or steal or be inspired by what's happening here and bring it into their own music. But there's something about this new generation of artists. They are edgy as hell. They are absolutely unforgivably themselves, like African and like super legit. And people like Beyonce, Diplo, the Gorillaz are collaborating with these young African artists. They're desperate to work with them because they're able to offer something that isn't anywhere else in the world. And they are like brutal. They're going in and they're doing their thing and they're starting to become international stars and take this African thing with them. And I've never seen it before. And it's given me a lot of happiness to see these young people just do it. Like, they're street, they're badass, and the world is like wanting piece of Africa. Okay. So that's been cool.
That's what it has to be. I mean, you have to exploit your own story and who you are, where you come from, and what makes you unique. I mean, when you embrace your own uniqueness, that's when you're going to move forward.
We have a confidence issue in South Africa, though, as artists. Like, we're wanting to be American. We're wanting to be something else. That's the thing that always held us back. What made you so special is that, you know, this will lead me on to I have two more questions for you. The first one is related to this, and that is, I wanted to ask you who you feel like, you know, you inspired such a, you know, all of the Afrikaans kind of music from Foko Politiko even owes such a feather to in your cap. What has been, when you do projects or hear, when, what has been, let me try and find a question here. What has been for you the most moving or most meaningful tribute or something that you have felt part of what has happened subsequently? Does that make sense, that question at all?
Yeah, I think I know what. Look, I mean, they had a concert at Opikopi quite a few years ago where a whole lot of, you know, artists were invited to do my songs kind of as a tribute to me. People, you know, like Karen Zoid and Jack Parra and Yevils Fantastis and I forget all the names now, but there were whole sort of the next generation of Afrikaans writers and performers came up and did my songs. And I mean, I was very, you know, moved by that and appreciated that. Perhaps I've lost touch with it, even the next generation. I don't keep up with everything that's going on. But you do look at it and I think to myself, well, okay, it's nice to see that we it kind of broke open. As I was saying, in the 80s, this wasn't, there wasn't
the
a
UNK.
Clear, there wasn't a clear way to do this. It wasn't as if there was a circuit that you could go on or anything like that. It was all we were having to cut our own little path through the forest. You know, you had to find your own way. You weren't following anybody else. There was nobody in front of us. There were no mentors. Nobody to mentor you. You just had to, whatever happened, you had to deal with it and hopefully deal with it in a way that worked for you. And, you know, luckily in my case, I made the right kind of decisions and I'm here today. You know, I'm still here. And I've been, you know, I've been writing songs for 50 years. I've been a professional writer, director, performer for 40 years since 1981, you know, 1980, well, it's now 40 years that I've done that. And so it's been good. What's the second question?
What do you still want to do?
Yeah, that's a difficult one to answer right now. You know, we spoke about this when we started in the COVID time, and, you know, one feels a little bit, as I say, I'm a bit disconnected now, and it's not as if I'm full of ideas and ambitions as to what I still want to do. I think essentially, you know, I want to just keep on being creative. You know, this is it. I mean, to continue, just it's important to continue writing and to be involved with other creative people. That's important to me. Not that I'm looking for any more success or anything like that. It's just the process of sitting down and making something. You know, whether it be the paintings I was talking about or whether it be a new song or something. But I'm not chasing any kind of goal to make that the next song or the next album or, you know, has to be a success. And who knows? Sometimes you get taken by surprise. You know, who knows what lies around the corner?
David Cromer, I love you so much. You have no idea. It's such a privilege to have you. Before you go, I'm going to hold on a second. I don't know if this is going to work. Let's just see if this thing is even. I just have to say, happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear David Cromer, who's turning 70, which is fucking amazing and incredible. And you look amazing. Nice rosy cheeks. Happy birthday to you.
I hope that's not the poison that we've been drinking.
That was my little joke at the end there.
Thanks,
thank you,
John,
so much for your time. I've loved chatting to you, and I appreciate it so much. And I hope to bump into you sometime in the real world.
Yeah, well, yes, I'd like to do that. That would be nice. Very nice.
When things ease off, I will take you for a dinner or something, and we can chat for realsies.
Let's do that.
Much love to you, sir. Have a great evening.
Goodbye. Good night.
Ciao, bye. If you enjoyed this episode of What's Your Poison, you're pretty cool because it was fucking great. Do us a favor and subscribe either on the Apple Store, the Spotify Store, wherever you are. Leave a comment, please. Let me say it again because you probably just skipped over it. Just leave a comment because it helps with the ratings and I would appreciate it. Also, go to johnsavage.com if you want to see all the rest of the episodes or subscribe to my newsletter. The end.